industrial system. Well, they didn't have to go into the shield fringe. Oh, we're still, this just shows you how bleak that environment is. This is some of the best of it, cleared and farmed, but you don't do very well on that sort of farmland, and you can see that already a good deal of it is coming back into forest. It's being abandoned now. The shield fringe is depopulating, at least for agricultural use. Oh, here, still with the shield. Now this, I really, sometimes this country just distresses one. Here is one of our great landscapes. This sums up so much of the Eastern Canadian experience. We are on Capitol Hill, looking at exactly what we should be looking at from Capitol Hill, at the Catholic Cathedral, at Eddy's Pulp Mill, at the shambles of the industrial town that was Hull, and all its French-Canadian colors and textures and tawdriness, but, and the shield fringe on beyond, the logs in the foreground, a wonderful, wonderful view. Couldn't be better. It just sums up Eastern Canada in so many ways. Certainly sums up the Ottawa Valley. What's happened to it just makes me weep. The bureaucratic black towers of Ottawa have risen. The cathedral is gone. Eddy's has either been moved or is being moved. Some French landscape architect came in and decreed that that whole shore should, of all things, be lawn. What a disaster. What just total insensitivity. You've got this marvelous landscape and you ruin it. Anyway, the French Canadians could go in other directions. They could go right on south into New England. But of course, as early as the 1790s, agricultural New England was overpopulated. New Englanders were beginning to move out, to move on in that great wave of New England settlement that would eventually reach into Minnesota and beyond, across the whole northern tier of the United States. So there wasn't agricultural land in New England, but there was an incipient factory system. And one could find laboring jobs in the new textile and boot and shoe factories. And of course, a great many French Canadians did, male and female. But again, running into exceedingly low wages because of their acute vulnerability. Or one didn't have to go so far. One could go into the eastern townships, that fringe of land between the St. Lawrence Lowland and the American border. But if one did as a French Canadian in the 1830s, 40s, or 50s, one would find that another people had beaten one there. These were the New Englanders, who'd already left the overpopulated conditions of New England. Most of them had gone on west, as I've said, into the American Middle West and beyond. But just the northern edge of that New England movement came into southern Quebec. And it brought a landscape that is totally different from that of a cultural landscape, totally different from that of the French Canadians. Here it is in all its crisp, fresh white and greenness. Well, this is New England in the eastern townships. But it was not just that the agricultural land was taken, so too had come in the institutions of early 19th century New England, such as the Masonic Lodge. So too had come some of the architecture of the seaboard United States, such as the temple building in the middle distance. It's mixed up. There are people here of English and Scottish background too, and you can see the church in the distance. Is of out of an architectural tradition that is not American. But still, my point is simply that this land, an area of possible French-Canadian expansion, was already taken. And two, a new industrial order is at hand in the 19th century, almost wherever French-Canadians turned. And as they moved, they can move north and encounter it on the fringe of the Canadian Shield. They can move into New England and find it there. And if they moved into the eastern townships, before very long, they would find it there as well. So some of them, again, could take laboring jobs, poorly paid, but a living. The wealth that such factories were producing, of course, went not into French Canadian hands, but into the hands of their English speaking managers, into houses. Here's a fine 1870s house in the Victorian Italianate style. There was a lot of wealth being generated, rather a genteel and comfortable life for some. But the French Canadians who went into the eastern townships fitted themselves in around the edges of all of this. The opportunity for them was meager. And of course, their competitive position was exceedingly weak because they brought none of the skills, they brought none of the education that was required to cope successfully in this sort of commercial and industrial environment. And exactly the same predicament faced them if they went into the towns, which finally, when there was nowhere else to go, they did in increasing numbers. Here's a Notman photo of the Montreal waterfront in the late 19th century. The commerce that is revealed by those docks and those ships is entirely in English hands. All the buildings along the waterfront were owned by English commercial interests as well. The central business district of Montreal in the late 19th century was just an overwhelmingly English-speaking place, and all the better residential areas were English as well. On the flanks of Montreal, there was only one, and the many mansions there, there was only one person of French-Canadian extraction, and he happened to be mayor of Montreal. If you go through the business records, it's only when you get down to the small shops that you begin to see a predominance of French-Canadian entrepreneurship. Otherwise, commerce in Montreal functioned entirely in English hands. Well, very quickly, as I'm using up too much time, here's the other end of the commercial system of the St. Lawrence Lowland. This rather too dark slide is taken from Lévis across from Quebec, and the Grand Trunk Railway, the terminus and connection with oceanic shipping, but all of this commerce in English hands. Here's, a wonderful sketch. We're under the battlement of Quebec, and we see the new steamboats, the shipping on the river, and again, what we are looking at is what the historian Creighton called the commercial empire of the St. Lawrence. And I'm simply reminding you that when French Canadians came into the towns, they encountered this, and they encountered the English wealth and the English control that went with it. Now, just up the hill, in the old marketplace behind the Church of Notre-Dame des Victoires, there was another market. And this one was French-Canadian, and it was there at the same time. But you see how different it is, how intensely local it is. It has no connections out into the larger commercial theater of the greater St. Lawrence and North Atlantic trading system. It's connected out to the farms in the outskirts of Quebec and no farther. French-Canadians participated in this sort of market, but they participated in the other only as wage laborers. And of course, this whole commercial and incipient industrial system could, by the mid-late 19th century, produce enormous wealth. This was Sir Hugh Allen's place, Ravenscraig. And you can see that this is not everybody's little home in the West. Here's the sort of parlor that one found in that type of resplendent Victorian mansion at the end of the 19th century. Well, I think, as English Canadians, we have to pause and we have to wonder to some extent where this wealth came from. And I guess what I'm saying is we have to remember that at least part of it came out of the situation that I've been describing, in which there was simply an exceedingly vulnerable labor force. It could be hired for a song because people had got themselves into an absolutely desperate situation, and there is no doubt whatsoever that much of the wealth of the English, the most successful English. Now, this is a bit of a caricature because, of course, there were poor Irish and poor Anglo-Saxons in Montreal at this time. But it's a caricature that nonetheless has a fair measure of validity. And I simply am reminding you about the origins of this wealth. Now, in all of this, the French-Canadian imagination, if you will, remained for a long time profoundly conservative. Even when the old rural society had been smashed. The French-Canadian reverie turned back to it. It turned back to an image of Canada in a golden age, the age of the French regime, that nobody understood very well, that was interpreted through the eyes of adoring parish priests who tended to extol the role of the priest in this society. He never had the role that people thought he had. But still, life then seemed easier. There was a prosperity, there was an ease that was not at hand, and of course the English were not there. And so it was that even until relatively recently in Quebec, a fairly substantial small town, the main street of a fairly substantial small town, would look like this. This is Verchères, opposite Montreal Island, and I don't know what the population of Verchères was, but it was quite considerable when I took this photo in the early 1960s. A small town in Ontario of the same size would have had its brick facades, its false fronts, its it was a small town, of course, with urban ambitions. It saw itself as potentially a major city. But here is exactly the opposite aspiration, an aspiration to get away from an alien world, a world that French Canadians were having an awful time adjusting to, a world that was controlled by a different population, a Protestant, an English-speaking population, and a whole situation that, to a French Canadian, was baffling and was overbearing. Now, of course, this nostalgia was all very well, but the world that lay around, the English-speaking world, and above all, the new industrial world, could not be pushed away. There it was. Wherever you turned, you found it. And here we are in a small town in the Beauce. The Beauce is an area of Quebec along the Chaudière River, the south shore opposite Quebec City, and about 30 miles away from the St. Lawrence River. Now, in this small village in the Beauce, an entrepreneur from New England, one John Brakey, had come in the middle of the 19th century. He'd established a sawmill. He was undoubtedly a shrewd and determined manager of his enterprise, and he did well. In the Depression, the Brakey family, his descendants, were the only people in the Beauce with any considerable capital, and they bought up a great deal of land. In the late 1960s, I don't know quite what the situation is now, the Brakey family lived in this place with its magnificent lawn. I think they played croquet on it. I know there was a swimming pool just out of the picture to the right. Look at the architecture, ostentatiously British and Tudor. Now, if you're a young French Canadian, and if you lived in Brakeyville, and if every day you walked along the road and you peered through the hedge and you looked at this and you thought of your own little house with two or three rooms, scrubbed clean, painted white every year, crucifix on the wall, and but you thought of the contrast between your circumstances and this, what did it do to you? Well, one of the things it could do is give you a very deep sense of inferiority. And I'm sure that as French Canada moved out of its rural mold and encountered a modern urban industrial world that it was so ill-equipped to deal with, that a great many French Canadians felt this sense of inferiority acutely. It came to be a dominant emotion with many of them. The other thing I think that would happen fairly naturally, perhaps irrationally, perhaps not, but is that one would get mad. And I suspect that in a very direct way, it is these two emotions that have surfaced most stridently in Quebec in the last 20 years. What seems to me to be remarkable in the Quebec of our day is not that it is a tumultuous, restless, unsettled place, but that for so long, Quebec was relatively quiescent. given the situation that it was in. But to explain that is a whole other story, and I simply don't have time to get into it. But it does seem to me that restlessness is a natural condition of Quebec, given the situation that I've described. I would ask you to remember, too, that so much of the English privilege in Quebec has, in the past, rested undoubtedly, as I've said, on the availability of very cheap French-Canadian labor, labor which was available because of the extraordinary box that French-Canadian agricultural society had got itself into in the 19th century, and the equally severe institutional weakness of that society that had lost so much of its urban character with the conquest, that had folded in back around a very simple, but in a sense, defenseless rural society that had taken on the modern world from that thin base. And I would ask you to remember, too, finally, that, of course, English power and privilege in Quebec for a long time looked after itself. There was no doubt whatsoever from the early post-conquest period on into relatively recently that English patronage entirely naturally looked after its own. Well, these are the main points I want to make. Just a few final summary remarks. Finally, what has all of this to say about problems of Canadian unity today? Basically, I think it means, turn these lights back on. Basically, I think it means that the tensions in modern Quebec are exceedingly deeply ingrained. Does this just hum when I lean over here? It doesn't. Certainly, and a lot of French-Canadian status seeking, politically and psychologically. Are there common geographic bonds between French-Canadians and the rest of us? Of course, French-Canadians once spread across most of Canada, but too thinly to leave much imprint. In Quebec and elsewhere, the two realms of French and English-speaking life have never been absolute, as the number of French-speaking Frasers and Johnsons attest. But the essential geographic common denominator is Canadians' common experience with a severely limited land. It is not just French Canadians who ran out of land. In one way or another, we all have. All of Maritime Canada backs into rock. Southern Ontario is a tiny peninsula. Prairie agriculture confronts the twin limitations of drought and growing season. We in this room, in the largest city on the West Coast, are less than 10 air miles from a particularly raw wilderness. More than anything else, these limitations have distinguished Canada from the United States. And of course, and this is the point, rather than binding Canadians together, they have separated the parts of Canada from each other. Whereas a common American dream spread continuously westward through the Appalachians, across the Appalachians, through the Ohio Valley, and on into the high plains, separateness is the common Canadian experience. We are an intensely regional country. We live in patches of settlement isolated by intractable land and scattered across 4,000 miles. Each major patch has a distinctive past. There has never been one northern relationship with the Canadian land, but many different relationships, all of them hard. Europeans have never had an easy time with the land in Canada, but the struggle has taken many forms, yielded many different results. This, of course, is the richness of this country, if we can find the wit neither to stifle it in the electronic and institutional barrage of a conformist society, nor to balkanize it in tiny parts that have no ears for each other. Thank you.